Welcome to Tungsten, bulletproof hacks for the moth-eaten. Consider me your grandmotherly accomplice for the next half hour. Tungsten broadcasts at the saddest hour on Wet'suwet'en territory through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC. No mysteries there, but I do want to take you on a three-part life hack adventure that stood me in good stead all my life. Mystery novels. In this first episode, I want to explore why these are such a good hack, and then dip specifically into the world of whodunits. You'll notice I didn't introduce myself. As per one of my life hack recommendations in this series, for the next month, you, Zed, can call me Omega. Shh. Let's go get into some mysterious mischief together. I have always loved puzzles, crosswords, Sudoku, jigsaws, and mystery novels. Puzzles and mysteries are good for your brain and for your self-confidence. With some books, I feel like I've accomplished a day of relaxation, but if I'm reading a mystery, I've given myself that, plus some mental exercise and a full-on, hardcore escape from anything that's bothering me. I have to concentrate to follow the threads offered and see if I can solve the mystery. Most books are a good escape, and they typically provide you with company immediately in a main character or protagonist. But sometimes you want to escape with a trusted confidant of a protagonist, someone who makes you feel safe even while everything around them is a puzzle. This is my kind of mystery novel. As a youth, my nose was always buried in at least one Nancy Drew mystery. I'd dive into the Hardy Boys, or Trixie Belden, or the Bobbsey Twins. Later, I discovered Ellis Peters and Dorothy Sayers, Wilkie Collins, and Agatha Christie. My grandparents loved Raymond Chandler and Arthur Conan Doyle. A series really appeals to me, because it means I can have some confidence that my protagonist will not fail me. A good protagonist might become a trusted friend. As you do, I've noticed a few things over the years when I devour a series. As much as her writing is remarkable, Agatha Christie tends to hold the cards very close to her chest, so I feel less like a partner in her mysteries and more like an onlooker. The real magic of her mysteries is that I become enchanted with her characters, like Hercule Poirot. I've read a few of Ruth Rendell's books, but I've discovered that hers are generally the most disagreeable characters ever conceived, and I always feel great relief when they get what's coming to them. Rendell and Christie do not typically write in the style of a dependable friend, so I've set those series aside. On the other hand, I've discovered Stieg Larsson through a movie version of his mystery, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I feel a strong affinity for Lisbeth Salander, and I love Rooney Mara. The writer and the movie director gave her a highly empathetic character that I don't feel in Rendell's books. Someone we'll consider more deeply in another episode is John Buchan, an excellent mystery writer. His character, Richard Hannay, is non-assuming, agreeable, and inclusive. He lets me in on his thinking, unlike Poirot, and I learn about geography, different cultures, personalities, and travel. Buchan was quite a colorful character with a Canadian connection, too. If I had to choose a pet protagonist, it would be Brother Cadfael from Ellis Peters' remarkable Cadfael series. Easy to follow the chain of clues and events, there aren't too many characters, and I always learn interesting tidbits about life. These books leave me wanting more. I want badly to visit Cadfael's hut and quiz him on herbs and maps and people in general. And finally, Dorothy Sayers wrote the Lord Peter Wimsey series, in which she's reputed to be the only mystery writer in love with her protagonist. It's always fun when you have a crush on a character. Do some research on the word mystery and you'll find a broad range of subgenres. There are thrillers, crime novels, and suspense novels. The cozy mystery, the historical mystery, the paranormal mystery. There are murder mysteries, the noir, the detective novel, or the whodunit. It goes on and on and on, and these genres can blur or stand alone. You can generally place these genres into seven main types. In the classic mystery, there's a crime committed, usually a murder, in a closed social setting like a small village or a university campus or at a club. The story revolves around the murder being solved and the murderer being caught. In a crime mystery, the plot focuses on the planning or commission of a crime while providing detailed descriptions of the criminal underworld. In a police procedural, otherwise known as hard-boiled, plots focus less on the criminal and more on the police investigation. Recent procedurals use scientific forensic technology to solve the crime. You might be drawn to noir mysteries, which are described as gritty. these protagonists tend to be complex characters who are flawed, risk-takers, and often self-destructive. I'm not personally keen on these authors, who include Dashiell Hammett, Raymond Chandler, Elmore Leonard, and Mickey Spillane. However, my one exception is Stieg Larsson. Then there's the Gumshoe, or private detective mystery, where the focus is a professional investigator who's experienced in the underworld, often an ex-cop or ex-military. I'm more invested in the cozy mysteries, which take place around a small or closed setting and typically involve a specific set of people. They're tidy, where the mystery is solved and the perpetrator is caught. Cozy mysteries are defined by their lack of graphic violence, explicit sex, or foul language. And finally, there are caper mysteries whose crooks are colorful misfits and the police are inept. The focus is more on the planning and execution of the crime rather than the solving of the crime. Kind of a Keystone Cops book. I found a neat division of mystery books into two types on the site time.com by writer Tana French. It explains why I find mystery such a good life hack for when I'm feeling isolated, and why I'm a devotee of the cozy mystery and less of the noir. And I quote, "Mystery books, for me, divide themselves into two types. One kind, Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes, is all about restoring order. The central questions concern concrete facts. Who did it? How did they do it? Truth in these stories is an objective thing, and answers are solid and definitive. By the end of the book, every baffling clue connects up to the others, and the killer's motive is clear. Good is separated from evil, the guilty are locked up, dead, or at least identified, and the innocent are free to move on with their lives. These books sometimes get dismissed as formulaic or simplistic, but they're a lot more than that. In a world that can often be chaotic and reasonless, we need these stories. We need to believe that sometimes things can fit together and make sense, even when it seems impossible. That someday our crisis will end and we'll be able to leave it behind. The clean resolution offered in the structure of these books, A kills B, C finds out who done it, makes a mystery the perfect genre to speak for the hard-won triumph of order and meaning. But there are also the wild mysteries. In these books, questions are left unanswered. Maybe the killer stays uncaught, or the process of solving the mystery leads to more upheaval instead of less, or the solution works against justice rather than bringing it to fruition. In wild mysteries, order isn't restored because order isn't the point. Truth isn't objective and solid. It's dark, slippery, double-edged. Good can't be neatly separated from evil. The crucial questions aren't questions of fact. They're more nebulous and tangled than that. What are we capable of? How much of who we are is determined by choice, by circumstance, or by nature? How do we respond to things that seem impossible to cope with? The questions stay unanswered because they're unanswerable. Mystery is also the perfect genre for exploring these tensions. It deals with the highest stakes, truth and justice, life and death, and the most complicated twists of the human mind, the processes by which a person takes the transformative and irrevocable step to murder. You'll find more on Tana French's commentary at time.com/collection/best-mystery-thriller-books. A good detective protagonist must be reliable, able to fit into most situations either as a witness, a confidant, or as a reliable source of information. They have to be observant, but fair. I like mine to look for the best in people, not the worst. Most protagonists have external interests and skills and experiences quite outside what's happening in the plot. That rounds out the character for me and makes them more likable. Life is not fair or kind, and people do stupid and cruel things, but there's usually in these books a moral compass that keeps you centered. Detective fiction is a subgenre of crime fiction in which an investigator, whether professional, amateur, or retired, investigates a crime. Some of the most famous heroes of detective fiction include Sherlock Holmes and Hercule Poirot. Juvenile detective stories feature the Hardy Boys and Nancy Drew. They've remained in print for several decades. I enjoyed researching the history of the detective genre, which apparently began in 1841 with Edgar Allan Poe. Bleak House by Charles Dickens includes a whodunit subplot, while Wilkie Collins, sometimes referred to as the grandfather of English detective fiction, is credited with the first great mystery novel, The Woman in White. T.S. Eliot called Collins's novel The Moonstone the first, longest, and the best of modern English detective novels, and Dorothy L. Sayers called it probably the very finest detective story ever written. Interestingly, The Moonstone established several features for the 20th century detective story, and here they are. An English country house robbery, an inside job, some red herrings, a celebrated skilled professional investigator, a bungling local constabulary, some detective inquiries, a lot of false suspects, a least likely suspect, a rudimentary locked room murder, a reconstruction of the crime, and a final twist in the plot, which is my favorite part. In every mystery, there are elements that we've come to expect, like clues or hints that assist both the detective and the reader to solve the mystery. Some of these are going to be red herrings, of course, or the element of distraction. While there are now tons of great authors to read and lots of subgenres, our focus in this episode is the whodunit, primarily with Dorothy Sayers. A whodunit, colloquial for who has done it, is a complex, plot-driven variety of the detective story where the reader engages in the process of detection alongside the protagonist. You've been listening to Tungsten, Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten, on CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC, and I'm Christine Bruce. Are your finances in a state? Is the whole process of doing your taxes a big mystery? May I recommend the services of Accounting on Broadway? Barbara and Brigida are the masterminds behind this accounting and bookkeeping business, which specializes in accounting for small businesses and tax services for personal accounts, small businesses, and farms. Accounting on Broadway is a proud member of the Canadian Bookkeeping Association. Take the mystery out of your income taxes with trusted gumshoes, Barbara and Brigida. As an example of the detective genre, I'd like to read parts of something called The Learned Adventure of the Dragon's Head by Dorothy L. Sayers. It's a short story along the detective mystery line that features Lord Peter Wimsey. Do come and look at these pictures, Uncle Peter. I'm sure it's an awfully old book. Lord Peter Wimsey sighed as he picked his way out of Mr. Folliot's dark back room, strewn with the flotsam and jetsam of many libraries. An unexpected outbreak of measles at Mr. Bultridge's excellent preparatory school, coinciding with the absence of the Duke and Duchess of Denver on the continent, had saddled the lordship with his 10-year-old nephew, Viscount St. George, more commonly known as Young Jerry, Jerrykins, or Pickled Gherkins. Lord Peter was not one of those born uncles who delight old nurses by their fascinating way with children. He succeeded, however, in earning tolerance on honorable terms by treating the young with the same scrupulous politeness which he extended to their elders. He therefore prepared to receive Gherkin's discovery with respect, though a child's taste was not to be trusted. Nothing much better was really to be expected from the cheap shelf exposed to the dust of the street. "Uncle, there's such a funny man here, with a great long nose and ears and a tail, and dog's heads all over his body. Monstrum hoc Cracoviae. That's a monster, isn't it? What's Cracoviae, Uncle Peter?" "Oh," said Lord Peter, greatly relieved, "the Krakow monster. Let's have a look." "Quite right. It's a very old book. Monsters Cosmographia Universalis. I'm glad you know good stuff when you see it, Gherkins. What's the Cosmographia doing out here, Mr. Follett, at 5 bob? "Well, my lord," said the bookseller, who had followed his customers to the door, "it's in very bad shape, you see. Covers loose, and nearly all the double-page maps missing. It came in a few weeks ago, dumped in with a collection we bought from a gentleman in Norfolk. You'll find his name in it, Dr. Conyers of Yelsel Manor. Of course, we might keep it and try to make up a complete copy when we get another example, but it's rather out of our line, as you know, classical authors being our specialty. So we just put it out to go for what it would fetch in the status quo, as you might say." "Oh, look," broke in Gherkins. "Here's a picture of a man being chopped up into little bits. What does it say about it?" "I thought you could read Latin." "Well, but it's all full of sorts of pothooks. What do they mean?" "Oh, they're just contractions," said Lord Peter patiently. "Solen quoque huius insulae cultures. It's the custom of the dwellers in this island, when they see their parents stricken in years and of no further use, to take them down into the marketplace and sell them to the cannibals, who will kill them and eat them for food. This they also do with younger persons when they fall into any desperate sickness." "Ha ha ha," said Mr. Folliot, rather sharp practice on the poor cannibals. They never got anything but tough old joints and diseased meats, eh? The Viscount was enthralled. I do like this book, he said. Could I buy it out of my pocket money, please? Another problem for uncles, thought Lord Peter, rapidly ransacking his recollections of the Cosmographia, to determine whether any of its illustrations were indelicate. On consideration, he could only remember one that was dubious, and there was a sporting chance the Duchess might fail to light upon it. Well, he said judicially, in your place, Gherkins, I should be inclined to buy it. It's in a bad state, as Mr. Folliot has honorably told you. Otherwise, of course, it would be exceedingly valuable. But, apart from the lost pages, it's a very nice, clean copy, and certainly worth 5 shillings to you, if you think of starting a collection. Till that moment, the Viscount had obviously been more impressed by the cannibals than the state of the margins, but the idea of figuring next term at Mr. Bultridge's as a collector of rare editions had undeniable charm. None of the other fellows collect books, he said. They collect stamps, mostly. I think stamps are rather ordinary, don't you, Uncle Peter? I was rather thinking of giving up stamps. Lord Peter gave it as his opinion that book collecting could be a perfectly manly pursuit. "I'll take it, please," said the Viscount, blushing a little at transacting so important and expensive a piece of business. Mr. Folliot bowed and took the Cosmographia away to wrap it up. "Are you all right for cash?" inquired Lord Peter discreetly. "Or can I be of temporary assistance?" "No, thank you, Uncle. I've got Aunt Mary's half-crown, and 4 shillings of my pocket money, because, you see, with the measles happening, we didn't have our dormitory spread, and I was saving up for that." The business being settled in this gentlemanly manner, and the budding bibliophile taking personal and immediate charge of the stout square volume, a taxi was chartered which, in due course of traffic delays, brought the Cosmographia to 110A Piccadilly. At Piccadilly, Gherkins and Lord Peter are visited by a Mr. Wilberforce Pope, who claims to be the nephew of the original owner of the Cosmographia. In this clip, Mr. Pope has attempted to offer to buy the Cosmographia from the Viscount. "Now you see, Lord St. George, I'm here to make you an offer for the book. Come now, double what you gave for it. That's a good offer, isn't it, Lord Peter? And you'll be doing me a very great kindness as well." Viscount St. George looked rather distressed and turned appealingly to his uncle. "Well, Gerald," said Lord Peter, "it's your affair, you know. What do you say?" The Viscount stood first on one leg and then on the other. The career of a book collector evidently had its problems, like other careers. "If you please, Uncle Peter," he said with embarrassment, "may I whisper?" "Oh, it's not usually considered the thing to whisper, Gherkins. But you could ask Mr. Pope for time to consider his offer. Or you could say you would prefer to consult me first. That would be quite in order." "Then if you don't mind, Mr. Pope, I should like to consult my uncle first." "Certainly, certainly," said Mr. Pope. "Very prudent to consult a collector of greater experience, what? Ah, the younger generation, eh, Lord Peter? Regular little businessmen already." "Excuse us, then, for one moment," said Lord Peter, and drew his nephew into the dining room. "I say, Uncle Peter," said the collector breathlessly when the door was shut, "need I give him the book? I don't think he's a very nice man. I hate people who ask you to decline nouns for them." "Certainly you needn't, Gherkins, if you don't want to. The book is yours, and you've a right to it." "What would you do, Uncle?" Before replying, Lord Peter, in the most surprising manner, tiptoed gently to the door which communicated with the library and flung it suddenly open, in time to catch Mr. Pope kneeling on the hearthrug, intently turning over the pages of the coveted volume, which lay as the owner had left it. He started to his feet in a flurried manner as the door opened. "Do help yourself, Mr. Pope, won't you?" cried Lord Peter hospitably, and closed the door again. "What is it, Uncle Peter?" "If you want my advice, Gherkins, I should be rather careful how you had any dealings with Mr. Pope. I don't think he's telling the truth. He called those woodcuts engravings, though, of course, that may be just his ignorance. But I can't believe that he spent all his childhood's Sunday afternoons studying those maps and picking out the dragons in them, because, as you may have noticed for yourself, old Munster put very few dragons into his maps. They're mostly just plain maps. A bit queer to our ideas of geography, but perfectly straightforward. That was why I brought in the Krakow monster, and you see, he thought it was some sort of dragon." "Oh, I say, Uncle, you said that on purpose." "If Mr. Pope wants the Cosmographia, it's for some reason he doesn't want to tell us about. And that being so, I wouldn't be in too big a hurry to sell if the book were mine, see?" "Do you mean there's something frightfully valuable about the book which we don't know?" "Possibly." "How exciting! It's just like a story in the boy's friend library." "What am I to say to him, Uncle?" Well, in your place, I wouldn't be dramatic or anything. I'd just say you've considered the matter, and you've taken a fancy to the book, and have decided not to sell. You thank him for his offer, of course. Yes. Won't you say it for me, Uncle? I think it would look better if you did it yourself. Well, perhaps it would. Will he be very cross? Possibly, said Lord Peter, but if he is, he won't let on. Ready? The consulting committee accordingly returned to the library. Mr. Pope had prudently retired from the hearthrug and was examining a distant bookcase. Thank you very much for your offer, Mr. Pope, said the Viscount, striding stoutly up to him. But I have considered it, and I have taken a fancy to the book, and decided not to sell it. Sorry and all that, put in Lord Peter, but my nephew's adamant about it. No, it isn't the price. He wants the book. Wish I could oblige you, but it isn't in my hands. Won't you take something else before you go? Really? Ring the bell, Gherkins. My man will see you to the lift. Good evening. When the visitor had gone, Lord Peter returned and thoughtfully picked up the book. We were awful idiots leaving him with it, Gherkins, even for a moment. Luckily, there's no harm done. You don't think he's found out anything while we were away, do you, Uncle? Gasped Gherkins open-eyed. I'm sure he didn't. Why? He offered me £50 for it on the way to the door. Gave the game away. Bunter? My lord? Put this book in the safe and bring me back the keys. And you'd better set all the burglar alarms when you lock up. Ooh, said Viscount St. George. Unsurprisingly, Piccadilly next gets a nighttime visit from two bungling burglars, sent there by Mr. Pope. Bunter has called Scotland Yard, who is about to quiz Lord Peter on the value of the Cosmographia, before carting the burglars off to jail. And now, Detective Inspector Parker of Scotland Yard, a great personal friend of Lord Peter's, sat toying with a cup of coffee and listening to the story. But what's the matter with the jolly old book, anyhow, to make it so popular? He demanded. I don't know, replied Whimsy, but after Mr. Pope's little visit the other day, I got kind of intrigued about it and had a look through it. I've got a hunch it may turn out rather valuable after all. If only Mr. Pope had been a trifle more accurate in his facts, he might have got away with something to which I feel pretty sure he isn't entitled. Anyway, when I'd seen what I saw, I rode off to Dr. Conyers of Yelsell Manor, the late owner. Conyers the cancer man? Yes, he's done some pretty important research in his time, I fancy. Getting on now, though, about 78, I think. I hope he's more honest than his nephew, with one foot in his grave like that. Anyway, I wrote to say that we had the book, and had been specially interested in something we found there, and would he be so obliging as to tell us something of its history? But what did you find in it? I don't think we'll tell him yet, Gherkins, shall we? I like to keep the police guessing. As I was saying, I also asked him whether he knew anything about his good nephew's offers to buy it back. His answer has just arrived. He says he knows nothing specially interesting about the book. It has been in the library untold years, and the tearing out of the maps must have been done a long time ago by some family vandal. He can't think why his nephew should be so keen on it, as he certainly never pored over it as a boy. In fact, the old man declares the engaging Wilberforce has never even set foot in Yelsell Manor to his knowledge. So much for the fire-breathing monsters and the pleasant Sunday afternoons. Naughty Wilberforce? Yes. So, after last night's little dust-up, I wired the old boy we were tooling down to Yelsell to have a heart-to-heart talk with him about his picture book and his nephew. Are you taking the book down with you? Asked Parker. I can give you a police escort for it if you like. That's not a bad idea, said Whimsy. We don't know where the insinuating Mr. Pope may be hanging out, and I wouldn't put it past him to make another attempt. Better be on the safe side, said Parker. I can't come myself, but I'll send down a couple of men with you. Good egg, said Lord Peter. Call up your myrmidons. We'll get a car round at once. You coming, Gherkins, I suppose? God knows what your mother would say. Don't ever be an uncle, Charles. It's frightfully difficult to be fair to all parties. The story now transports us to Dr. Conyers' home, Yelsell Manor. The manor grounds are described in some detail, followed by a conversation with Dr. Conyers, who explains why the will's promise of treasure has significance for him. Yelsell Manor was one of those large, decaying country mansions which speak eloquently of times more spacious than our own. The original late Tudor construction had been masked by the addition of a wide frontage in the Italian manor, with a kind of classical portico surmounted by a pediment and approached by a semicircular flight of stairs. The grounds had originally been laid out in formal manner, in which grove nods to grove, and each half duly reflects the other. A late owner, however, had burst out into the more eccentric sort of landscape gardening, which is associated with the name of Capability Brown. A Chinese pagoda, somewhat resembling Sir William Chambers' erection in Kew Gardens, but smaller, rose out of a grove of laurustinus towards the eastern extremity of the house, while at the rear appeared a large artificial lake dotted with numerous islands, on which odd little temples, grottos, tea-houses, and bridges peeped out from among clumps of rushes, once ornamental, but now sadly overgrown. A boathouse, with wide eaves like the designs on a willow pattern plate, stood at one corner, its landing stage fallen into decay and wreathed with melancholy weeds. My disreputable old ancestor, Cuthbert Conyers, settled down here when he retired from the sea in 1731, said Dr. Conyers, smiling faintly. His elder brother died childless, so the black sheep returned to the fold with a determination to become respectable and found a family. I fear he did not succeed altogether. There were very queer tales as to where his money came from. He is said to have been a pirate, and to have sailed with the notorious Captain Blackbeard. In the village, to this day, he is remembered and spoken of as Cutthroat Conyers. It used to make the old man very angry, and there's an unpleasant story of his slicing the ears off a groom who'd been heard to call him Old Cutthroat. He was not an uncultivated person, though. It was he who did the landscape gardening round at the back, and he built a pagoda for his telescope. He was reputed to study the black art, but there were certainly a number of astrological works in the library with his name on the flyleaf. But probably the telescope was only a remembrance of his seafaring days. Anyhow, towards the end of his life, he became more and more odd and morose. He quarreled with his family, and turned his younger son out of doors with his wife and children. An unpleasant old fellow. On his deathbed, he was attended by the parson, a good, earnest, God-fearing sort of man, who must have put up with a deal of insult in carrying out what he firmly believed to be the sacred duty of reconciling the old man to this shamefully treated son. Eventually, Old Cutthroat relented so far as to make a will, leaving to the younger son, my treasure which I have buried in Munster. The parson represented to him that it was useless to bequeath a treasure unless he also bequeathed the information where to find it. But the horrid old pirate only chuckled spitefully, and said that, as he'd been at the pains to collect the treasure, his son might well be at the pains of looking for it. Further than that, he would not go, and so he died, and I dare say went to a very bad place. Since then, the family has died out, and I am the sole representative of the Conyers, and heir to the treasure, whatever and wherever it is, for it was never discovered. I do not suppose it was very honestly come by, but, since it would be useless now to try and find the original owners, I imagine I have a better right to it than anybody living. You might think it very unseemly, Lord Peter, that an old, lonely man like myself should be greedy for a hoard of pirates' gold. But my whole life has been devoted to studying the disease of cancer, and I believe myself to be very close to a solution of one part, at least, of the terrible problem. Research costs money, and my limited means are very nearly exhausted. The property is mortgaged up to the hilt, and I do most urgently desire to complete my experiments before I die, and to leave a sufficient sum to found a clinic where the work can be carried on. During the last year, I have made very great efforts to solve the mystery of Old Cutthroat's treasure. I've been able to leave much of my experimental work in the most capable hands of my assistant, Dr. Forbes, while I pursued my researches with the very slender clue I had to go upon. It was the more expensive and difficult that Cuthbert had left no indication in his will whether Munster in Germany or Munster in Ireland was the hiding place of the treasure. My journeys and my search in both places cost money and brought me no further on my quest. I returned, disheartened, in August, and found myself obliged to sell my library in order to defray my expenses and obtain a little money with which to struggle on with my sadly delayed experiments. Ah, said Lord Peter, I begin to see the light. Dr. Conyers had invited his guests to stay the night, and after the excited Viscount had been packed off to bed, Whimsy and the old man sat late, consulting maps and diligently reading Munster's chapter, De Nois Insulis, in the hope of discovering some further clue. At length, however, they separated, and Lord Peter went upstairs, the book under his arm. He was restless, however, and instead of going to bed, sat for a long time at his window, which looked out upon the lake. The moon, a few days past its full, was riding high among small, windy clouds, and picked out the sharp eaves of the Chinese tea-houses and the straggling tops of the unpruned shrubs. Old Cutthroat and his landscape gardening. Whimsy could have fancied that the old pirate was sitting now beside his telescope in the preposterous pagoda, chuckling over his riddling testament and counting the craters of the moon. If Luna, there is silver. The waters of the lake were silver enough. There was a great smooth path across it, broken by the sinister wedge of the boathouse, the black shadows of the islands, and, almost in the middle of the lake, a decayed fountain, a writhing celestial dragon shape, spiny-backed and ridiculous. Whimsy rubbed his eyes. There was something strangely familiar about the lake. From moment to moment, it assumed the queer unreality of a place which one recognizes without ever having known it. It was like one's first sight of the Leaning Tower of Pisa, too like its picture to be quite believable. Surely, thought Whimsy, he knew that elongated island on the right, shaped rather like a winged monster, with its two little clumps of buildings, and the island to the left of it like the British Isles, but warped out of shape, and the third island between the others and nearer. The three formed a triangle, with the Chinese fountain in the center, the moon shining steadily upon its dragon head. Hic in capite draconis ardet perpetuo. Lord Peter sprang up with a loud exclamation and flung open the door into his dressing room. A small figure, wrapped in an eiderdown, hurriedly uncoiled itself from the window seat. "I'm sorry, Uncle Peter," said Gherkins. "I was so dreadfully wide awake, it wasn't any good staying in bed." "Come here," said Lord Peter, "and tell me if I'm mad or dreaming. Look out the window and compare it with the map, old Cutthroat's New Islands." "He made 'em, Gherkins. He put 'em here. Aren't they laid out just like the Canaries? Those three islands in a triangle, and the fourth down here in the corner, and the boathouse where the big ship is in the picture, and the dragon fountain where the dragon's head is. Well, my son, that's where your hidden treasure's gone to. Get your things on, Gherkins, and damn the time when all good little boys should be in bed. We're going to go for a row on the lake if there's a tub in that boathouse that'll float. Come on, crew." Lord Peter hitched the leaky dinghy to the dragon's knobbly tail and climbed out carefully, for the base of the fountain was green and weedy. "I'm afraid it's your job to sit here and bail, Gherkins," he said. "All the best captains beg the really interesting jobs for themselves. We'd better start with the head. If the old blighter said head, he probably meant it." He passed an arm affectionately around the creature's neck for support, while he methodically pressed and pulled the various knobs and bumps of its anatomy. "It seems beastly solid, but I'm sure there's a spring somewhere. Well, it isn't its back hair, anyhow. We'll try its eyes. I say, Gherkins, I'm sure I felt something move, only it's frightfully stiff. We might have thought to bring some oil. Never mind, it's dogged as does it. It's coming, it's coming! Booah!" A fierce effort thrust the rusted knob inwards, releasing a huge spout of water into the face of the dragon's gaping throat. The fountain, dry for many years, soared rejoicingly heavenwards, drenching the treasure hunters and making rainbows in the moonlight. "I suppose this is old Cutthroat's idea of humor," grumbled Whimsy, retreating cautiously round the dragon's neck. "And now I can't turn it off again. Well, dash it, let's try the other eye." He pressed for a few moments in vain. Then, with a grinding clang, the bronze wings of the monster clapped down to its sides, revealing a deep square hole, and the fountain ceased to play. "Gherkins," said Lord Peter, "we've done it. There's a box here, and it's beastly heavy. Give me the boat hook. Now, I do hope the old sinner really did have a treasure. What a bore if it's only one of his little jokes." As he paddled the boat around, it was evident that something was happening down by the boathouse. Lights were moving about, and the sound of voices came across the lake. "They think we're burglars, Gherkins." "Is that you, my lord?" said a man's voice as they drew into the boathouse. "Why, it's our faithful sleuths," cried his lordship. "What's the excitement?" "We found this fellow sneaking around the boathouse," said the man from Scotland Yard. "He says he's the old gentleman's nephew. Do you know him, my lord?" "I rather fancy I do," said Whimsy. "Mr. Pope, I think. Good evening. Were you looking for anything? Not a treasure by any chance, because we've just found one." "Oh, don't say that. Maxima reverentia, you know. Lord St. George is of tender years. And by the way, thank you so much for sending your delightful friends to call on me last night." "Oh yes, Thompson, I'll charge him all right." "You there, doctor? Splendid. Now, if anybody's got a spanner or anything handy, we'll have a look at great-grandpapa Cuthbert. Now, if he turns out to be an old iron, Mr. Pope, you have had an uncommonly good joke for your money." An iron bar was produced from the boathouse and thrust under the hasp of the chest. It creaked and burst. Dr. Conyers knelt down tremulously and threw open the lid. There was a little pause. "The drinks are on you, Mr. Pope," said Lord Peter. "I think, doctor, it ought to be a jolly good hospital when it's finished." To read this and other great short stories by Dorothy L. Sayers, visit archive.org and search for Lord Peter, a collection of all the Lord Peter Whimsy stories. You've been listening to Whodunits on Tungsten Bulletproof Hacks for the Moth-Eaten. Tungsten is produced by Christine Bruce, aired through CICK 93.9 FM in Smithers, BC, available anytime at smithersradio.com or anywhere you get your podcasts. See you next week, when we'll explore my favorite mystery genre, the cozy mystery. For years, I've been enthralled with historical mysteries that fall into the cozy mystery genre, specifically those written by Ellis Peters. Her comforting protagonist is a Welsh medieval monk named Brother Cadfael. I reread a few of the series before launching this episode, and they do not disappoint. In case you need a little fix this week, I'll leave you with one excellent life hack. Look for and focus on the best in people. Sometimes the easiest way to avoid being isolated is to not put up boundaries or limit your thinking about someone else. See you next week.